Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Mine does filtered water too, so you know the water you're drinking is of good quality. I think British water is pretty much good quality anyway, isn't it? I'm now talking about stuff I know nothing about, as usual. Thank you for your continued support listening to these podcasts. Listen, I hope you enjoy them as much as I enjoy having the conversations. As you know, I decided to keep them an hour in length, which is a challenge for me because I can talk for hours and hours and hours. But I felt it made the podcast a better listen. 1 hour seems a good duration. This one just ekes over an hour. I could have gone on forever talking about the future and what we'll be like in the future. But I kind of just thought, you know, let's keep it an hour. It seems to be the way to go. Let me know what you think anyway. You can email me at lovejoyhour@gmail.com. You can email me about anything else as well, you know, if you're enjoying it, any questions you've got, or any guests that you think I should get on. Today's guest is Andrew Steele, who's written a book called Ageless. This, you're going to love this subject. It's absolutely fascinating. He says, after obtaining a PhD in physics, I'm reading from inside the book, at the University of Oxford, Andrew Steele decided that aging was the most important scientific challenge of our time and switched fields to computational biology. He worked at the Francis Crick Institute using machine learning to decode our DNA and predict heart attacks using patients' medical records. He's now a full-time science writer and presenter based in London. Well, let's find out, how not to age and what computational biology actually is. Here's Andrew Steele. Andrew, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
First question is computational biology. What actually is it?
That is a very good question. It sounds like something incredibly sort of high-tech and highfalutin, but actually all it is analyzing biological data with computers, because we've got to this stage in sort of the progress of biology now where we're generating huge amounts of data. You know, I could sequence your genome for less than $1,000 and we could do it in an afternoon. And just to sort of emphasize how ridiculous this is, the Human Genome Project, which was the first attempt to like look at every single letter of a human's DNA, cost billions and billions of dollars, and now we can do it for a grand, you know, in a few hours. And so that means that we're generating huge amounts of data because we're sequencing tens of thousands of people's genomes, every single one of these 3 billion letters of their DNA. So basically you need to get some nerds to organize all that data to work out what's going on, and that was what I used to do.
What does that entail every day then? Well, I know you're now a publisher and a broadcaster and you're an author, but what did you actually used to sit and do? Would you be sitting in front of a computer screen then?
Yeah, it's strange because I think, so even for one of the photo shoots for the book, I was wearing a white coat, and that's actually the first time I've worn a white coat professionally, because I used to, it's an office job, computational biology. You do a lot of coding, you know, it's more sort of in R and Python and programming languages rather than in a spreadsheet. Some of it's done with spreadsheets. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's a lot of sitting at a computer, you know, going, talking to your colleagues in the lab and asking them, you know, trying to help understand their side of the problem. But yeah, it's you know, computer, keyboard, that's how it works.
Okay, I'm going to have to get my head around a lot of this stuff. Science wasn't my favorite subject at school, but I blame the teachers, not my intelligence. Are we at the stage now where a computer is better than a doctor for finding out what's wrong with you?
Not yet, but I wonder, like there's slow progress towards computers taking over from bits of what doctors can do and helping them make decisions. So one of the things that I was doing when I was working back at the Crick was using people's medical records to try and predict when they were going to have a heart attack. And the idea with that was, you know, you'd look back at all the NHS medical history that they've got for you, everything, your GP records, every operation you've had, every time you visited the hospital. And then you use a computer to sort of pull together all of that data and work out how likely you are to have a heart attack. Now, at the moment, I think, you know, computers probably aren't better than doctors at that kind of thing. But what this can do is provide a help, a sort of decision aid tool to a doctor. So imagine you go to your GP and they're saying, well, you know, should we start you on something like statins? What they want to know is how likely are you to have a heart attack? And therefore, you know, are you, is it risky enough that it's worth giving you some pills that you're going to have to take every day, might have some side effects? And so they would basically click a little button on their computer, which would then look back through your medical record. It will calculate your personal risk. And if it exceeded some threshold, the doctor would say, okay, yeah, I think it probably is worth giving him some statins or giving him some other, you know, blood pressure lowering medication or other preventative drugs. And so it's that kind of thing that's happening now. But there is going to come a point where computers can look at your genome, your medical records, everything, and make proper diagnoses.
Did you find out how accurate your predictions were on people having heart attacks?
Yeah, and it's annoyingly hard to explain. It was basically about 70% accurate at guessing how long away it was going to be. But it's quite hard to explain like what exactly that 70% means. Basically, it was quite good. It was better than tossing a coin, which is always the sort of the absolute lowest threshold you go for.
Right. Okay. It's funny. I'm just having a blood test next week, and I'm hoping it gets run through a computer, because that's how I perceive it to have the best results now. So we're changing as consumers, aren't we? Well, patients, consumers, whatever the hell we are, the general public. I want a computer to analyze it, because I assume it'd be more accurate.
It's interesting, yeah, because it certainly feels intuitively like computers are getting cleverer, the algorithms are getting smarter. Obviously, you know, we've got these computers in our pockets now that we carry around with us every day that are how many hundred times more powerful than the computers that we used to land on the moon. So I think we're really getting close to a stage where computers are going to be able to help doctors and outdo doctors in certain tasks. I don't think we're quite there yet in most places, but it's a really fascinating time to be a doctor or a radiologist, because you're going to have computers helping you out in quite big ways in your job over the next 10 or 20 years, I think.
My mate Pete always says to me, can you imagine carrying a compass around with you all the time? Because you are in your phone. And I'm like, and I always think, well, and he's always trying to make a point that years ago you'd buy a compass, and then if you wanted to, you'd carry it around. But now you've got one on your phone that you never look at. Yet we perceive compasses to be so exciting. And yet we've all got it on our iPhone, but we never look at it. Okay, it says you've got, in your book, it says you decided that aging was the most important scientific challenge of our time. Why?
Fundamentally, because it causes the greatest amount of death and suffering out of everything in the whole world. So let's think about this in a slightly morbid way at first. Your chance of death doubles about every 7 or 8 years. So what that means is that you get a much, much increased chance of death the older that you get. And if you were to look at everyone all around the world and work out what causes them to die, there are about 150,000 people die every day on planet Earth. And about 100,000 of them, in fact, a bit more, die of aging. They basically die of diseases like cancer, like heart disease, like dementia. All of these things that we know from our everyday experience, you know, we know from our friends, we know from our relatives, mainly affect people who are older. You know, you very rarely hear of a cancer patient in their 20s or 30s. It does happen, but it's much, much more common in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s. And something like dementia, unless you've got a specific genetic change that predisposes you to that disease, you basically almost can't get it before the age of 60. But then the risk of dementia doubles every 5 years after that. So it's just rapidly, rapidly increasing risk. And so what that means is that by understanding this process that puts us at greater risk of all these diseases, we can hopefully come up with ways to defer them, to prevent them happening before we get ill in the first place. So that's why I just think it's this enormous challenge that we really need to do something about.
So this is the important thing. I mean, at one end of it, you're trying to get us to maybe live a little bit longer. But the most important thing you're trying to do is the quality of life is as good as it can be. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I sometimes do myself a bit of a disservice by always talking about death statistics. But the fact is that death is really easy to measure. Like, there's no ambiguity. You're dead, you're not dead. We can easily just, you know, tot up the number of people and sort it out. But the problem with all these things like cancer, like heart disease, like dementia, they don't just, you know, take you out in the snap of a fingers. You know, you don't just not wake up one morning having had a perfectly healthy life until that point. You normally suffer for years. You know, your heart, say you've got heart disease, you slowly lose the ability to run around and play with your grandkids, then start to lose the ability to do your stuff around the house. You can't get up and down the stairs quite so easily anymore. If you think about dementia, it sort of slowly claws away at your memories, your personality, everything for such an extended period of time. So it's that huge sort of chunk of suffering that unfortunately most of us have got to look forward to at the end of life that I really want to do something about.
Are there any stats on how much time we spend ill?
It really varies from person to person, but like, you can definitely expect to be getting a bit more frail in the last 20 years of life. In the last 10, I think my favorite stat that sort of makes sense of this is if you think about an 80-year-old, which is, you know, a lot of us can expect to live to the age of 80 these days. The average 80-year-old has 5 different medical diagnoses, and they're taking an average of 5 different drugs to treat those as well. So that means, you know, you've got a load of different things wrong with you. It's not as though you've just got cancer or just got heart disease. You might be battling cancer at the same time as your heart's sort of in the first stages of heart failure. Or, you know, you might have a little bit of cognitive decline. Perhaps it's not quite enough to be called dementia. So all of this stuff's happening at once. It's very hard to like tightly define, because, you know, when does cognitive decline pass over? You know, when are you forgetful enough, or when have you lost your personality enough that we can call it dementia? So that's why I sort of stick with these death statistics, because they're nice and easy. But yeah, it is all about the suffering for me.
What's the life expectancy at the moment? Are we, have we had people who are born who will live to 140 or something yet? What do we think?
I think that people who have been born in the rich world since the year 2000, it looks pretty likely, if nothing changes, and I stress this is quite a conservative prediction. This is basically if the continuation of current trends is what we got to go on, and that's to say that life expectancy has been going up by about 3 months every single year since the beginning of the 19th century, then that means that kids who are born this century can expect to live into their hundreds probably. However, I wonder if that could be quite a bit higher, just because if we start actually treating the aging process, which is something that we haven't done so far, then we could, you know, it's very hard to know exactly where that ceiling is going to be.
Every time we've predicted how long we should live for, it's always gone past that, hasn't it?
Yeah,
so far, hasn't it? In history, I think, yeah.
There's a hilarious paper, and, you know, as hilarious as a scientific paper can be anyways. It's just very, very dryly funny, where some demographers went back and looked at all the different predictions. Because, you know, when you're trying to work out what's happening to lifespan back in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, everyone was like, oh, we must be nearing the maximum human lifespan now. So what's going to happen is lifespan has been going up for the last 150, 200 years, but it's going to plateau. It's going to stop going up. And every time one of these predictions was made, this paper notes that on average, 5 years after the prediction was made, it was broken. So it's just like these people are just so pessimistic.
So what happens when a pandemic comes along?
It's a fascinating question. And I've wondered about this. You can really see, if you look back at the life expectancy through the 20th century, there's a really big dip in the 19 teens. And what you might instantly think is, oh, that's obviously the First World War. But actually, if you zoom in a bit closer, you can see that the biggest dip happens in 1919 or so. And that's because of the pandemic of 1918 flu that happened back then. So what I've been scratching my head about is, you know, is COVID going to get big enough that we'll see a little dip in the life expectancy statistics? Or is it going to be that, you know, basically things are going to continue largely unchanged? I think until we see how the stats shake out from the last year, it's hard to know. But definitely pandemics can have a serious effect on life expectancy, at least for a brief time.
I'm going to ask you a question which you're not going to like, but you'd have to answer it. How do we get rid of a pandemic? How do we get rid of a virus? Sorry. How do we get rid of this thing? Because it just seems to be, it seems to be mutating. We don't see it just seems we're going to be in constant lockdown. And I fear for countries like New Zealand and Norway and Singapore and Taiwan, as soon as they open up to us idiots, we're going to take our diseases in again, aren't we? You know, it's like, I can't see a way out of this. Do you think it just eventually burns itself out?
I feel like, and I've become increasingly convinced by this, even back in March, I was wondering, why isn't the government following the South Korea, Taiwan playbook? And we can now add New Zealand to that list as well. And Australia has been fairly successful too. They've had a few, you know, big outbreaks, but they managed to suppress them. I really think it's going to be a massive challenge if we don't lock down long enough and hard enough that we can get to a point where test, trace and isolate can keep numbers under control. So the problem is, you know, if you've got tens of thousands of cases a day, then each of those tens of thousands of cases has, say, 10 or 20 contacts. If you've got to ring up all of those people that they've been in touch with over that day, like, you need an army of contact tracers. We're going to need to devote like 10% of the economy to contact tracing, which obviously isn't viable. Whereas if we can have a lockdown and get the numbers down to low enough, you know, perhaps like they were over the summer in the UK, we get to a point where we can use test, trace, isolate. And if we can then support people in their isolation, because one of the big problems we've got is that people on low incomes, you know, they can't afford to stay at home for 2 weeks to make sure they don't pass on the disease. So if we can get testing, I think we've more or less sorted that in this country. But if we can get the tracing and the isolation down and then really crush the numbers, and obviously the vaccine's only going to help as well, it's going to be a frustrating thing and it's going to be a multi-pronged attack. But that's how I'd get rid of this particular pandemic, I think.
I wonder if we have to re-examine the world the way the world works. Maybe we have to look at universal credit to make sure people don't go out and, you know, when they're infected. I wonder if we need to look at taxation, and I don't know why I'm asking you this. I'm not sure, especially subject, but I wonder if we need to start. I mean, I've discussed it on other podcasts, taxing the people. We don't have any of the money. You know, the companies have the money. Maybe we need to start getting the money off the companies and rethinking the whole tax system so that we can afford to do all these things. You know, there's plenty of money out there. Look at Jeff Bezos. He's got quite a lot of money. They reckon the 10 richest people in the world, if they put their money together, they could vaccinate the whole world, just the 10 richest people. I mean, it's insane, isn't it, that there's that much money? Anyway, let's move away from that. I put it to you that, Andrew, that we're living too long, and that is your problem, not the quality of life. We should be dying earlier. Is that a valid point?
Do you really think that? What's your ideal world? You're asking this question. Do you think that we should get to, I don't know, 50 or 60, and we should just pop off to some clinic somewhere, and they give us an injection and we just disappear with no pain?
Well, Andrew, I wonder that you say that people over the age of 80 have got 5 different ailments and taking 5 different pills. We're getting quite good at keeping people alive, aren't we? And I wonder if those people would have died sooner and had and not have the poor quality of life at the end.
That is a good question. I tried to sort of dig into this while looking at the book. And again, I'm going to fall back on my excuse that death statistics are always easy to get your head around. But when you dig into the statistics about quality of life and length of time spent with disability, there's a little bit of controversy around this, but it looks as though we're actually effectively, through all the different things that we've done, and none of this, I stress, is actually medicine against aging, but by things like improved hygiene, improved lifestyles, and medicine for specific diseases like heart disease, what we've done is effectively delayed the aging process almost by accident. And so we've got this same sort of period of ill health at the end of life and just deferred it by about 20 years. And so there are nuances. It varies a bit from country to country. But I think by and large, people these days are spending a smaller fraction of their life in ill health because they're spending the same amount of time in ill health overall, approximately. But we've just moved it, a decade or two later, depending on where you start counting.
I imagine it's a good industry to be in. I imagine, talking about all those rich guys just a minute ago, I bet they're putting a lot of money into this area. I mean, anti-aging and war must be the two great things we like spending our money on, and people like to make advancements on. Is there huge sums of money going into anti-aging at the moment?
I really wish there was. I think the fundamental problem is there are some big investors. There are billionaires who are making investments in biotech companies that are starting to develop the first sort of real anti-aging treatments. The stuff I'm talking about isn't skin cream. It's not trying to make you look more youthful. It's actually trying to rejuvenate your cells and the molecules inside your body. So there is investment being made into that, and I am excited that that's starting to become an area of investment. But I think we really need to see some government funding of this as well. Because the fact is that a lot of the stuff that I talk about in the book, these aren't completely crazy ideas, but a lot of them are either on the drawing board or they've been demonstrated in cells in a lab or demonstrated in animals in a lab, and they're not ready for these billionaires or these big pension funds or whoever to come and invest in those kinds of technologies. We need governments to be doing some of this work, because what a government can do is it can make really, really big bets. They can say, okay, we're going to fund 1,000 research projects, and we don't know if any of them are going to work, but it might be that 1 or 2 or 3 of them hit really, really big. And that means that, after 10 or 20 years, you get such a huge return on your investment that it more than pays for all the other 997 that didn't do anything. And the problem is that even if I'm a billionaire, I can't afford to invest more than my entire fortune for a period of 20 or 30 years to see if it will come off. Whereas as a government, that's exactly the kind of bet they should be taking.
Yeah. We'll get stuck into your book in a minute. But I wonder that you talked there about skincare regimes. That seems to be what people are obsessed with. The public are more obsessed, aren't they, with what they're doing with their faces and maybe their external bodies than their internal organs and what else is going on, because we can't see it. I suppose that's why we're all told, aren't we, constantly not to eat too much, not to have too much caffeine, not smoke, not to drink too much. And yet a lot of us do. Someone gives a skin aging cream, the new one, they're like, I'll buy that. And it's like, well, just stop drinking so much or eating crap. So yeah, that is, it's not, the Botox world doesn't seem to be working too well, does it? Is there a concern that people are too obsessed with the outside of them and not the inside?
I think what we've got to do is really show people the connection between those two things, because there was a fascinating study that was done in 2009 that showed that the older you look on the outside, basically the older you are on the inside at the same time. And so what they did was they showed a panel of people, these photographs of other people, And they said to them, how old do you think this person looks? And they found out the person who looks older was more likely to die. They were more likely to get diseases sooner. So what the sort of wrinkles, the gray hair, the cosmetic stuff on the outside is showing us is what's going on the inside. And I had a really fascinating chat with a scientist who is working on what happens to our collagen as we age. And you might recognize the word collagen. It's a protein that holds together a lot of the different parts of our body. It holds together our skin. It holds together our arteries. It holds together our bones. And you often see it on the side of tubs of skin cream with various dodgy claims attached to it. And so she was looking at how that changes as we age. And I said, so, you know, if I could give you, you know, 100 million quid to do exactly what you wanted to come up with your perfect research program to try and sort this out. She said, what I'd go after is the collagen in your arteries and in your veins. And that's because the stiffening of our arteries is what causes high blood pressure. It's one of the big factors behind it. And high blood pressure causes heart disease. It causes dementia. It's just one of the biggest sort of silent killers in the modern world. And so she was saying, you know, I'd far rather have sort of youthful, supple arteries and slightly saggy older skin than the other way around. And actually what's really amazing about that is because it is essentially the same process as happening to the collagen. It's quite likely that I did give her, if only I had the power, if I did give her a £100 million grant, she sorted out collagen in our arteries. We could probably use very much the same technology to try and improve a lot of the collagen in our skin as well.
You know, I'm going all over the place here, but I'm picking up on things you're saying, because I was given a jar of collagen once by someone, a big sort of pot of it. And if I was apparently to consume that, it would help with my collagen. And then I was interviewing, I can't remember who it was now, one of the scientists or professors or doctors I've had come on my podcast. And the pot was there. I only did it once. And they looked at it and went, you might as well just flush that down the toilet. That doesn't work. And then I started talking. Actually, it was Tim Spector. And he said he doesn't think any of these supplements really work. That you might as well flush most of them down the toilet. Is that what you think from your research?
I think so, yeah. So the way that I try and assess the evidence on this, you often find these, the evidence behind these things is often quite dodgy. And the reason is it's often cherry-picked, very small studies. You know, the manufacturers will get, they might even do 10 studies and leave 9 of them in the drawer, the ones that didn't work, and they just publish the one that did or something like that. So what you like as a scientist is what's called a systematic review, which is where some nerds have like gone through, they go on basically Google for Scientists, which is a site called PubMed. And on PubMed, you can find every single medical or biological paper. So you type in particular combinations of words, you find every paper about collagen or about vitamins or whatever it is. You pull them all together. You go, well, this one looks a bit dodgy because we don't like the methods that it was using, or this one has really good statistics, we like that. And you combine them all to get your best possible estimate of the effect of these particular drugs or particular supplements. And when you look at ones for vitamins, they often just have so little effect. There was one of these systematic reviews done of vitamin pills, and they found that some vitamins basically have no effect on your lifespan. You know, they don't make you live any longer. And some of them actually make it increase. They increase your odds of death, not by a huge amount. So it's not like you're killing yourself, you know, instantly by popping a few vitamin pills. But unless you've got a specific vitamin deficiency, your body is pretty good at pulling out the vitamins it needs from the food and hanging on to the ones it does need, and obviously weeing out the ones you don't, which is where a lot of the vitamin pills you take end up going down the toilet. So yeah, I just think it's frustrating how many of these products are sold with so little evidence.
Though the placebo effect, I imagine, has a way of working.
Yeah, and what the best, so systematic reviews that I talked about, they're sort of the gold standard of evidence. And what they tend to like to do is to pull together the randomized trials that are underlying the evidence that underlies them is randomized trials. And the idea in a randomized trial is that you give half of people the vitamin pill, and you give half of people a pill that looks exactly the same as the vitamin pill. It's in the same bottle, yeah. It's got the same label, but it doesn't have any actual vitamins in it. And then you watch those two groups of people. And so if there is a placebo effect, then obviously the people in the placebo group will experience that effect as well, and you can sort of cancel it out.
We become obsessed with vitamin D at the moment because of the internet and everyone's saying if you take vitamin C, huge dose of vitamin C will apparently stop you getting vitamin D stops you getting coronavirus, and vitamin C is the one that heals you immediately. Now, I don't know how much truth there is in either of those, but the vitamin D one can be quite dangerous because, as I understand it, if you do take too much vitamin D, that's actually bad for you. Whereas vitamin C, you'll just wee out, even though you actually can overdose on vitamin C, I read the other day. I don't know. I see, this is so much information on the internet, isn't it?
The fact is you can overdose on anything. There's, I think, I can't remember what the number of liters you have to drink is, but you can overdose on water because you can get to a point where you're just diluting everything inside your body. Yeah. And so you'll just die for that reason. It is just really, really hard to get to the bottom of the evidence on this stuff.
You can't overdose on love. let me throw that out there. Just your mind, how about that? As you're aging, the connection between the mind and health is strong. We know that, you know, healthy mind, healthy body, all that sort of stuff. Surely at some stage, your mind starts deteriorating as well. And I don't mean in a dementia way. I mean in a like, oh, I've lived so long and you know, fatigue and tiredness. And, you know, do people look at that side of things as well?
I'm really interested to try and extricate the link. So let's have a think about the biological side of it first. I think the good news about this is that although we don't fully understand what's going on in the aging of the mind, and I think the lack of cures for dementia is like a really good example that shows us it's a difficult part of the body to understand. It's probably, you know, the most complicated object in the universe is the human brain. So, you know, clearly there's a lot to still understand about the biology. But the good news is that the same basic biological processes seem to be driving the aging of the brain as are driving the aging of the rest of the body.
Yeah, but not the aging of consciousness. See, because we don't know what that is. And so that's the one thing we can't get off. I know I'm getting a bit hippy trippy here, but but you can look at the neurons firing, I suppose, in the brain, but you can't work out why we think the way we think, our thought processes. And as you know, everyone's getting up at the moment and they're getting dressed in the morning and then they realize there's a pandemic and some of us are getting slightly miserable. We don't know why, do we?
No, I mean, fundamentally not. And the thing that makes me optimistic about this as well, and obviously we don't know because we haven't got any healthy, you know, 110-year-olds to talk about, because anyone who reaches that age has inevitably experienced, you know, some changes to their biology. But I think that a lot of the sort of changes in disposition, that, you know, the depression that's sometimes associated with old age, it's because a lot of depressing stuff is happening to you. Your friends and your relatives are dying. You're experiencing extreme frustration getting around the house. I chat to my poor granny and she's having trouble getting up and down the stairs and opening jars, and just every single little job every day is so annoying. Like it's impossible for you and me, you know, both youngish, both fittish, you know, we can just do whatever we want basically with no impairment. And so it's hard to imagine if you suddenly find yourself really isolated, you can't get out of the house to go and, you know, see people, even if it wasn't for the pandemic, and you're getting physically less fit around the house, and, you know, lots of your friends and relatives are gone anyway. I think that we're going to find that if we have longer, healthier lives for lots of people and everyone, you know, around you is still alive, you're still able to go out and do those activities you enjoy. I'm not saying there'll be no psychological changes, you know, as we get to older and older ages, but I think a lot of the bad stuff will be reduced.
Yeah, I wonder which way round it's going to be. Did you watch that documentary on the octopus? It's something like Lessons from an Octopus or something. After she'd given birth, I didn't realize octopi, I don't know what they're called. Anyway, they don't live for a very long time. They're only a matter of years. But once she'd reproduced, she then got ready to die, and then she got. I won't ruin it for you, but she didn't. It wasn't a pretty ending, but she didn't seem to care. She just sort of. And I wonder if we get to an age one day where we think, do you know what? I've done my bit here. It's time to go. Time to move on. And so the body then starts deteriorating, which I suppose leads me nicely on. I love your book, by the way. It's two parts. The first part, you really work my brain. The second part's a little bit easier, but the first part, a lot of science in it, all about why we age. Why do we age?
Well, that is a very good question. That is the longest and I'd say toughest chapter of the book. Because the point is that you have to go around every single system in your whole body to understand it. And I break it down into 10, what I call hallmarks of the aging process. And these are the fundamental underlying cellular, molecular, biological causes of aging. And let's just go through a few of them because, you know, I think they do make sense if you pick them out on quite a simple level. So if you talk about the damage to your DNA, inside every one of your cells, you've got your genetic code. And that genetic code is the instructions that tell the cell how to behave, you know, tell it what to do. If it's a muscle cell, tell it how to be a muscle cell. If it's a brain cell, I tell it how to be a brain cell, and so on. And so as you get older, as you go through life, you start accumulating damage and what are called mutations, so changes to this genetic code. So obviously, as you get changes to that instruction manual, then the cells can start to misbehave. And the most common way they misbehave is cancer, because if they collect basically the wrong collection of mutations, that can cause them to divide out of control. And that's how you get a cancer. So that's one idea. And as I say, there are quite a few others there that, you know, the cells can get old inside your body, you can get damaged, the proteins or your proteins can clump together in various ways that can be problematic. And then all of these sort of microscopic nitty-gritty biological changes, what they do is they aggregate up together to make our organs, our systems in our body start to fail at the same time.
So So there's a few ways we can stop it. You've put four ways in your book, so we might as well run through them. The first one's out with the old and in with the new. What does that mean?
So let's give an example of one of the hallmarks where that makes sense. I think this is actually probably the most exciting thing in current aging biology. It's the idea that our cells themselves can age. And what these are called is senescent cells. So these are cells that have either divided lots and lots of times. So basically, you know, they're clapped out old in that respect. They can get too much of that DNA damage that I mentioned. So if they get too many problematic changes to their DNA, the cell will stop dividing.
Can I just interrupt you there?
Yeah, of course you can.
Is it a good way to think about that with our skin? Because we can actually see that. So our skin, when it starts getting old and wrinkled, that is the photocopy of the photocopy of the photocopy, is it, of the cell, and it's starting to deteriorate.
Exactly. And something that can happen, particularly in your skin, is that exposure to UV light in the sun, if you don't wear enough sun cream, if you go out lots and lots, go a lot on the beach, what you can find is that the UV damages that DNA. And so you've got the photocopy, the photocopy, the photocopy effect of your skin constantly refreshing, plus you've got the damage to the DNA from all that UV light. And that's what causes the cells in your skin to age, basically.
Right. But then it's also the double whammy is from internally, because I understand alcohol and tobacco and drugs and stuff also hits you. So that's happening internally at the same time, is it?
Yeah. If you look at your cells, inside your cells, it's a busy, bustling place, right? Because your body is, you're eating food, you're breathing, and what you're doing with that, those chemicals, you know, the oxygen in the air, the various chemicals in the food, is that you're using them to generate energy. And because you're generating energy, by definition, they're very reactive chemicals. And that means that they're just sort of buzzing around. They can bash into your DNA. They can cause a problem that way. So it's just, you know, a lot of the mutations, you know, we think about alcohol, we think about sun exposure, we think about all these external causes, but actually a lot of the mutations are happening just because of the natural chemistry of being alive.
Right. Okay. So I interrupted you. You were saying about out with the old and in with the new.
Yeah. So these senescent cells, for various different reasons that we've just gone into a bit of detail about, they accumulate in your body as you get older because, you know, you've lived for longer. So your cells are divided more times. You've been out in the sun a bit more. So you've got a few more cells that have got UV damage, et cetera, et cetera. And what these cells do is they don't just sit there benign, you know, not dividing, not really causing any trouble. They give out molecules that basically accelerate the whole aging process. And so, you know, they can cause all kinds of other changes around your body. They can increase the chance of cancer. They can increase the chance of heart disease. They can make your skin wrinkle, et cetera, et cetera. Now that might be, you know, quite a depressing thing. We've identified a hallmark, but the idea is that we can, out with the old, we can get rid of some of these aged cells. We can give you drugs that will remove these aged senescent cells from your body. And currently we're trialing this in humans, so we aren't sure, you know, exactly how it's going to work. But what we have done is we've made it work in mice. You can give aged mice this treatment. You can give them a combination of drugs that will kill these senescent cells. And they basically get biologically younger. They get less cancer. They get fewer cataracts. They live a bit longer, obviously. They can run further and faster on a treadmill. So in these experiments, they have little tiny mousy treadmills inside the cages, and they can watch how much they use them and how fast they go. They even have better fur, which strongly suggests that these senescent cells are sort of globally driving so many different facets of the aging process, and getting rid of them allows the mice to live longer and, most importantly, in good health.
How close are we to doing that in humans?
I think really close. So there are 20 or 30 companies now that are trying to turn this idea of killing senescent cells into treatments for the clinic. And at first, these trials are going to be looking at specific diseases, because we know that senescent cells, for example, are really heavily involved in arthritis or lung fibrosis. And these are diseases that we know happen in older people. We find senescent cells at the sites of these diseases. But what's probably going to happen is hopefully these drugs will be safe. They'll be effective. And if they work, we can say, OK, if these are safe enough, maybe we can start giving them out to people who haven't got arthritis or lung fibrosis yet, but just to prevent all of these different diseases before they even get ill in the first place.
Do you think that this aging process, all this stuff is... Do you think it's done for, I'm going to use the word again, is it done for love, or do you think it's done just for financial gain? Where do you think the motivation is for the companies to be doing this?
My motivation is love. And I think there's definitely a lot of that in the scientific community, because, right, you know, the fact is, who wants to see their parents get dementia, or who wants to, you know, see their kids get, you know, die of cancer, even if it's going to be decades after you're already gone? Like, all of this stuff for me is about the health benefits. And I think that's true of a lot of scientists as well.
Interestingly, Botox was originally for people with tics, wasn't it? And they were injecting it into people with muscle tics.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
It was to stop muscle ticks. And then they realized that it was, you know, because it was paralyzing the muscle. I spoke to one of the skin doctors who was involved in it. And he said when everyone started doing it for cosmetic, they were really worried. And they sort of said that this is a really bad idea. There's going to be side effects. Just do it. And it turns out it's been all right. You know, that doesn't.
Well, I just think it's amazing that Botox is short for botulism toxin.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, people inject that stuff in their face.
Sticking poison into you. Yeah. So that's the first one. And the second one is in with the new replacement therapy.
And the idea behind... The idea behind that is that a lot of things in your body basically degenerate with time. And so we're going to have to come up with ways to replace them. And I think a really good example of this is your immune system. So we all know that old people are much, much more affected by things like coronavirus than young people are. You know, obviously, I think your chance if you get coronavirus, if you're over the age of 80, is hundreds or even thousands of times higher than if you're in your 20s. And one of the big reasons for that is that your immune system's getting older. So you're getting less effective at fighting off bugs. And not only that, but your immune system also does a lot of important work inside your body. So it looks around, it basically spots cancers that are in the process of becoming cancers. And so as your immune system gets less effective, it means cancer is more likely to sort of slip past those defenses. And one of the really key organs in your immune system is just behind your breastbone, between your breastbone and your heart. And it's an organ that not that many people have heard of called your thymus. And if you've been listening to the news about coronavirus vaccines, you might have heard of a T cell. The reason that T cells are called T cells is because they come from the thymus. It obviously starts with the letter T. And that thymus shrinks incredibly rapidly. So I'm afraid yours and mine, Tim, they're pretty much completely gone. It halves in size about every 15 years. So by the time you're a teenager, you've lost half of it. By the time you're 30, you've lost three quarters of it. By the time you're in your 70s, there's basically nothing left. So the idea is that we can get something like stem cells, or we can use hormones, or we can use gene therapy. There are a variety of different approaches that are being trialed to try and grow back that thymus. And that means that we can produce more fresh new T cells. And that means that if we're confronted by a threat like coronavirus, or if we've got a cancer growing inside us, these fresh new sort of sprightly T cells being produced by a rejuvenated thymus can sort that problem out for us.
I was listening to a podcast on the stem cell center in Panama. Have you heard about that one? Where they take this thing called the golden cell. I'm out of my depth here, but it's the juice apparently of the golden stem cells. And what it does, they were saying in this podcast I was listening to, it rejuvenates your stem cells to think they're young again. And then you suddenly start repairing everything, and it starts. I mean, it sounds like a miracle. I've gone onto their website because I thought I fancy doing that. I've got a few problems with my back and my knees and things like that, but there's disclaimers all over it saying this is not approved by whatever. What do we know about stem cells? It seems to be kind of an interesting science, growing science, doesn't it?
It really is. And there's a great the annoying thing is I'm almost certain that what they're doing has absolutely no medical proof behind it at this moment, but there is a grain of truth to what they're doing. So actually, do you mind if we skip forward into the next chapter that you're going to ask me about, which is about repairing stuff inside the body?
Yeah, let's do it. 100%.
Let's do it, because this is a really good time. So the idea is that, and I'm going to describe quite a grim scientific experiment now. They got some rats, an old rat and a young rat, and they sewed those rats together. It's a process that's called heterochronic parabiosis, which has got to be the greatest euphemism in science. So heterochronic meaning different ages, and parabiosis, which means living beside, which sounds lovely, doesn't it? But then, if you actually work out what the scientists are doing, you know, it's a bit of a macabre thing. But they were doing this to try and understand the differences between the old and the young rats and mice in the experiments. And what they found, they did some of these experiments were done in the 70s. They're a bit inconclusive, and they only really came back in the 2000s. And this experiment that was published in 2005, what they found is that the old mouse that was attached to a younger mouse, its stem cells would be basically rejuvenated. They were able to regenerate parts of the body in ways that they weren't able to if an old mouse was sewn to another old mouse, or if it was an old mouse that was just scurrying around the cage on their own. And so the suggestion is there are some factors in the blood of younger mice that are enhancing the regeneration, or there are some factors in the blood of the older mouse that are suppressing their regeneration. And by sticking them together, hopefully we're going to come up with ways of doing this without sewing old people to young people. So we're trying to identify what those factors are and come up with ways to encourage those stem cells to be able to repair parts of the body again.
Don't those lunatics in California take their blood out and put young people's blood in to try and replicate that?
There has been exactly that, yeah. So Peter Thiel is a famous supposed benefactor of this, because he went on the record in an interview saying that he was really fascinated by this idea of injecting young blood. And there's a company called Ambrosia that set itself up, and you can get a pint of young person's blood for $8,000, or you can buy one, get one half price. At the time I looked on their website, which is so you get two for 12,000. It's just phenomenal. And what's most sort of bizarre and frustrating about this is it's just like the stem cell clinics. Not only is it not clinically proven, it's clinically proven not to work, because there was an experiment in 2014 where they just gave mice old mice young mouse plasma, so effectively doing the same treatment that the humans are getting by getting the young person blood plasma, and it didn't do anything. It didn't extend their lifespan, it didn't make them any healthier. So there's definitely something to this sort of these heterochronic parabiosis experiments, but it's not as simple as just the mice swapping blood.
What's your final chapter on this one? Reprogramming.
And this is the chapter, it felt the most sci-fi, but it also feels like in some ways it could be the most exciting. So actually, I'm going to talk about stem cells again, because they are everywhere. There was a Nobel Prize that was awarded a couple of years ago for something called induced pluripotent stem cells. So that's a bit of a mouthful. Induced means that you can create them in the lab. Pluripotent means that it's a type of stem cell that can become any cell in the body. So when you start out, as a not even a baby, a fetus, not even a fetus, you're a fertilized egg, you're a single cell. And that cell divides and divides and divides, and it becomes everything in your adult body. It becomes your muscles, your bones, your brain, your eyes, your liver. Everything is made from this single cell. So it's what's called a pluripotent stem cell. And these were originally interesting. We've now basically worked out how to turn the clock back in cells in the lab. So I can take some of your skin cells, put in a cocktail of genes, and turn that skin cell into a pluripotent stem cell, an induced pluripotent stem cell. And what that then means is that I can create any sort of cell that I want. So say you've got, say we're trying to rejuvenate your thymus, for example. We could make a load of thymus cells for you and pop them into your breastbone, or pop them anywhere in your body, actually, and start making new T cells. So that's the first reason people are excited about this sort of stuff, because you can make any kind of cell in the body. But what we've since found is that you can put these genes, these same genes that make these stem cells, into any cell of the body. And in fact, even into a whole mouse, and you can activate them. And they seem to turn back the whole biological clock. They basically make the mice biologically younger. Again, exactly like removing their senescent cells did. They make them live healthier. They can improve their regenerative capacities. And we call this reprogramming, because you're effectively reprogramming the cells into a younger state. And it just feels like we've been sort of handed a cheat code to biology from the future, because it's incredible that these four genes, you know, you've got 20,000 genes. You know, so somehow you can just use four of them to turn back the clock. It's amazing.
What about cloning? I mean, look, if my heart's not good and I want to stay young, I can have a heart transplant. And everyone goes, yeah, that's fine. Why can't I clone another me and just take... I mean, we've got moral and ethical problems here, haven't we? But isn't that just a good idea to get a young heart and stick it inside me? If we're going to start sticking young stuff inside me constantly, why can't I get a young arm or a young heart or a young liver or a young kidney?
And I really hope we can get to that point. Like, that is a really good end goal for regenerative medicine.
Really?
Yeah, because, you know, exactly as you say, the problem with organ donation is you're basically waiting for a young person to die in a car accident. And thankfully, cars have got a lot safer in the last 50 years. So that means we've got very, very few people dying of car accidents. And as people are living longer, there's more and more need for organ transplants. So we're going to have to come up with some way of making those organs. And we're certainly not there yet. But there's going to be a time, hopefully in the future, when we can just take out a few of your skin cells, or a few cells from an innocuous part of your body that you don't really need, take them to the lab, turn them into stem cells, grow you a new heart, pop it in. Bob's your uncle.
Yeah, but we can't do that. I mean, we've got to have a discussion about how much of that can we do, though. I mean, why can't I do the whole body and just try and get my brain cells, the ones that which are firing, into a new body? You know, give myself a body from a 18-year-old Tim Lovejoy.
I mean, ultimately, it's possible that could be something that we could do one day. I suspect it's going to turn out to be easier to fix some of your body in situ, rather than to, you know, completely build you a new one and somehow wire a brain in, because that would just be a surgical nightmare. But essentially, that's what this technology is trying. You know, I'm not saying that's necessarily what we should be going for because of all the moral and ethical qualms, but essentially, it is possible. So you can, for example, if you get some of these induced pluripotent stem cells from mice and implant them into the womb of a mouse mum, basically, then they grow up to be a full mouse. So they can clearly become whole bodies. They can become any part of the body that you want.
Well, why not? Why don't I have two hearts, three livers, I mean, you know, four legs, I can make myself better. If we're going down that road, then I think, well, like one heart is all right. But if I've got two, then there won't be as much stress on them both. As long as I can get them
working. It'd be nice to have backup, wouldn't it?
It's a real problem that we've got to, because we're getting closer to it, aren't we? And we've got to work out what's right and what's wrong. You know, if we can make us so we can live to, I don't know, 250 years old, then, I mean, is there a reason why we can't do that? The planet might become overpopulated. There are animals out there, aren't there? I mean, jellyfish, do they live forever?
Yeah, and the reason there's a Galapagos tortoise on the front of my book is because they don't live forever, but they have something called biological immortality, which isn't real immortality. As I say, they don't live forever. But what they have is a risk of death that doesn't change depending on how old they are. So it really shows you that this aging thing that we all consider to be such an inevitable fact of life, I mean, it literally isn't a fact of life. It's not a law of biology. There are animals like the Galapagos tortoise, like this jellyfish, that don't age. And actually, jellyfish...
So you're telling me this tortoise, I mean, it's the good thing about the tortoise, it starts out looking old, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But you're telling me that this tortoise does not necessarily have to ever die.
Yeah. I mean, if it got lucky, that tortoise, let's say it's emblematic of Harriet, which is the tortoise I talk about at the beginning of the book. She made it to 175 and was basically doing as well as she was when she was a young adult tortoise. The oldest current tortoise is... chap called Jonathan, at least the oldest recorded one. He's living on a zoo on St. Helena. And there was an article I read in the Times a couple of years ago about how, you know, he's still getting on with the ladies. He's still doing everything that a frisky young tortoise would be expected to do. So it's amazing. These animals just don't age.
That's it. If you listen to the Mel Gibson podcast, and when Mel Gibson talks about the Panama Stem Cell Research Clinic, I don't know what it's called. He talks about putting his dad in there. That's why he found out about it. And he does it for his shoulder, but his dad's maybe in his 90s or something. And he said, the great thing about it, because it's made him feel amazing, is his dad's back having sex again. And he said, that's what happened. It rejuvenated, made him feel young again. So, you know, it's like that sounds very positive. If it actually
something to aim for.
Yeah, maybe. So I can't get my head around, why aren't there 600-year-old tortoises running around the place then? Because they get eaten or something?
There's a combination of things. Firstly, they can get eaten, they can get a disease. There's all kinds of, you know, external factors that can befall them. And secondly, you just have to be incredibly lucky. So the risk of a tortoise's risk of death every year is about 1 or 2%. So let's say it's 1% to make the numbers easy. That means on average, they'll live to be 100. And that means if you're a 100-year-old tortoise, you can on average expect to live another 100 years. But the trouble is, you just got to keep tossing that coin every single year. And admittedly, it helps because it's a 100-sided coin and there's only one side that says death. But you just got to keep on tossing that coin. And imagine, you know, tossing a coin with a 1% chance of you dying every year for 600 years. It's just not going to happen statistically. So it's not like biologically impossible, probably. It's just the statistics aren't in your favor.
This is On My Last Eggs.
You get to a point in your life, you think, hang on, I'm kind of falling apart, everything's sagging, you know, what's going on?
A new podcast that talks frankly about being in the wild throes of menopause and perimenopause.
There's the insomnia, the anger, the rage, I mean, boiling, infernal, Vesuvius-al rage.
I'm Rachel New, and every week I'm going to explore more about these messy and confusing years with friends and experts, and if I can get one, a Spice Girl.
I get really cross with the word designer vagina. There's nothing designer about my vagina, I can tell you that now.
I'm having a real epiphany here, or as I like to call it, appropriately enough, an epiphany.
Find On My Last Eggs every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get yours.
And I love that title. Very good. I wish I'd thought of it. I really do.
Okay. I want to go down to a road now that I'm not going to understand anything, but I'm going to give it a go. I assume you talk a lot about code, and I find this fascinating because you talk about humans in code, and I assume that's DNA code. I assume that we're going to get to a stage soon that before we do let the sperm hit the egg, we will be looking at the code in the sperm and the egg to make sure that it's as healthy as possible. We can't be that far away from eradicating all forms of illness and anything we can perceive that a human would have in the future. We can look at the DNAs and the, again, I apologize here because I'm probably saying something really stupid, but we can look at the code. Let's use the word code, can we? And go, okay, well, let's rearrange it all a bit here so that, that the baby's healthy and the human has a chance of living to 200.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's actually how we're going to end up doing something about aging. I think there are certainly going to be, so there's already the ability to do what's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. What that means is that before, so say you're doing IVF, before you implant the developing embryo into the mother, you can check to make sure there's nothing obviously wrong with it. And the easy one to check for that a lot of women I think do go for is to look for Down syndrome. And the reason Down syndrome is so easy to see inside your cells, you might have heard of the X and Y chromosomes, which are basically how we determine sex in humans. And there are loads of other chromosomes as well. Most of them are X-shaped. And Down's is what's called a trisomy. So rather than having two of a particular X chromosome, you have an extra one, you have a third one. So that's really easy to spot. You can basically see that down the microscope. If you're a bit more, you know, if you're not a computational biologist, if you actually have some lab skills, you can go and do that. And there are some diseases that are caused by single genetic changes. So, you know, single mistakes in your DNA effectively. So I talked earlier about how unless you have a particular genetic change, you basically won't get dementia before the age of 60. We know a few of those genetic changes and we can look for that change. If I, you know, if you were to sequence someone's DNA, you go, oh, look, there's a letter A there. That shouldn't be a letter A. Therefore, they've got this particular, you know, genetic problem that's going to predispose them to dementia. So again, you could potentially, you know, if you're happy with the ethics of that, select, you know, for children who weren't going to get dementia in their 30s. And I think that's quite an easy case to make. It gets harder when you start talking about diseases like cancer and heart disease. There are a few genes that make you much, much more likely. And you can, like the BRCA genes, for example, you might have heard of, which are the ones that give you a massive predisposition to breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And that's why, who was it, which extremely famous film star, this is your department rather than mine, it had a double mastectomy a few years ago. Angelina Jolie, wasn't it? I think. They have these preventative mastectomies where they just have both their breasts removed because there's such risk of breast cancer because of this BRCA mutation. So again, that's something you could think about screening, but it's starting to get more borderline. And the reason that most of us get cancer and heart disease isn't because we've got one specific nasty mutation that we were born with that then, you know, goes on to massively increase our risk. It's sort of a combination of all our genes working together. It's our environment. It's what we eat. It's, you know, just the inevitable sort of rough and tumble inside ourselves that I was talking about of being alive. So it's very, very hard to prevent a kid from getting cancer by deleting all the genes that could cause cancer. You'd end up deleting a load of genes that are really important for other stuff and what are keeping you alive in the first place. So I think apart from these, apart from diseases that have a really simple genetic cause, where you can say that DNA letter there or that extra chromosome there is what's causing the disease, I think we're going to end up treating them as adults. So we're going to end up treating them in the ways that I talk about in the book, where, you know, we try and remove some of the bad cells, or we try and treat the cancer, or we just try and do things, you know, as we get older, rather than sorting it all out before we're born.
This is an uncomfortable conversation, isn't it, Andrew, discussing this? And I tell you why. It's because we suddenly have to start valuing life, don't we, and put a value on life. And we can move it on to me because it's interesting. I have a slight problem with my genes and it affects my lymph system. So I imagine in the future they would have looked at the Tim Lovejoy egg and gone, nah, that one's not quite right. Let's get rid of it. And then we can find one which is more perfect than that, because that one's carrying the faulty gene. And I imagine that's another moral and ethical problem we've got to discuss in the future, isn't it? What we're going to do and how we value all life. Interesting thought process we're going to have to go through in the future.
I think we can hope for at least some of these things that we're going to be able to fix them, rather than just, you know, discarding Tim Lovejoy. We'll be able to, you know, send in something that will fix that particular change in your genetics and then allow you to, you know, develop to be a healthy baby.
With the amount of eggs that women produce and the amount of births they want to produce, it's all getting a bit Handmaid's Tale as well, isn't it? But with the amount of eggs and I wonder in the future if we're going to be saying, if you have a natural birth and you take the risk, a bit like, you know, we say to kids, I think they do in America, if you're not vaccinated, you can't come to school. And I kind of see it in the future, insurance companies going, unless you are screening the eggs and the sperm problems with it. Can't think of the right word, but unless you're screening, we're not going to insure you because we don't know what sort of baby you're going to have. You can see that happening, can't you?
Yeah, it's something that I think we've got to be really wary of. And I think what's what's sort of fascinating, and again, you know, without necessarily advocating for this, but imagining that we live in such a, if we live in even the more dystopian version of that future, where we are screening every single bloody embryo, and there's this sort of, you know, the insurance companies have got a stranglehold on the you know, the natural birth humans versus the ones that have been screened. Maybe the people in that time would look back on us as sort of primitive and barbaric for allowing all these kids to be born with terrible problems. So it's just so important that we have this debate before we get into that situation and we can't even, you know, see the problems that we've caused.
You articulated that so much better than I did. And also, it's just so true, because we look back, we only have to look back 50 years, 100 years, you know, infant mortality rates were higher 100 years ago, you know, and really high. People are having a massive amount of children because infant mortality rates were high. And we look back going, God, that's incredible that that used to happen. So it's moving pretty rapidly. And it seems to me that medicine, let's call it, or science, whatever we label this, it's moving rapidly, faster than it's ever moved. Am I right in that?
I think so, yeah. And I think it's basically because all the enabling technologies, is what we call them, have grown so, so rapidly. And computation is a really fantastic example. You know, as I was saying earlier, we're carrying around these phones in our pockets that are more powerful than the computers that, you know, did the moon landings by, you know, perhaps tens or hundreds of times. I can't remember the statistics. But the fact is that, you know, I couldn't have been a computational biologist like I was 20 or 30 years ago, because the computing power just didn't exist. I was doing some work with neural networks on GPUs, which are graphics processing units that people use for gaming. And that the sort of side effect of the development of these GPUs that, as I say, mostly are used by people trying to put the graphics up really, really fast on their computer screen so they can have a really immersive computer game, has been that we've been able to do research on these GPUs because they're just so powerful for particular kinds of computer application. And that means that you can just, you know, you can test hypotheses that you just couldn't have tried 50 years ago. And that means that science is just going to go faster and faster as we get better computing, as we get better at sequencing genomes. All of this stuff means more data, more numbers for people like me to crunch, and faster progress, hopefully.
Yeah, and I wonder if the lines between artificial life we're creating, because we keep using the word code, and you are now just going to computer and looking at code of the human, and we're creating code, artificial intelligence algorithms, we know that. And we know that a computer can now beat a man at chess, and we know a computer can compose classical music, which we can't tell. So we are creating sort of life now. I wonder if your mob are blurring the
scientists.
Your mob, yeah, the computative scientists, that you're blurring the lines between the real code and artificial code. I think we might be going down that road as well.
Yeah, it's really fascinating the extent to which computers are going to revolutionize biology. There was a development late last year. I think it was December last year, so about a month or two ago, where scientists at DeepMind, which is a company that's part of Google, managed to solve something called the protein folding problem. And the idea is that our proteins inside our cells, they fold up in these incredibly complicated ways that we've been, you know, scratching our heads about for decades. We've known this is one of the fundamental problems of biology. And they got some artificial intelligence, and they've just leapfrogged all the other people trying to understand this problem. And we don't obviously know exactly how the computer's done it, because it's AI. It's got some clever internal mechanism. We don't really know what it's doing. So it's just giving us such powerful tools to understand all this stuff.
So I want to get into my questions, Juba. But the conclusion to this is, it's so exciting. It's rapidly moving. It looks like we're going to live healthier lives for potentially longer. However, we do need to sit down and start talking about what's morally and ethically correct. We can't have rogue nations going, well, we'll just clone you. And then, you know, we don't know what will be happening then. We've got to do, it's a minefield, isn't it? It's a mess. I don't know where we go with it, because we're moving too quick. Well, not too quickly, but we're moving so quickly, aren't we?
Yeah, there was this really, really controversial, was this last year or the year before, but a guy called Hui Zhangkui, a scientist in China.
Yeah.
What he did was he used a technology called CRISPR, which you might have heard of. It's a gene editing technology to edit the embryos of babies. And his idea was to try and make them more resistant to HIV. Unfortunately, the science behind it was very, very shonky. Like the edits he made, it's not certain what effect they'll have had. They weren't really at that much risk of HIV anyway. And so that was, you know, instantly internationally condemned by the scientific community. But I think the real challenge is, not only is this stuff moving really quickly, but you can order CRISPR kits online. You know, I could almost do it in my garage. You know, you just mix together some stuff in a test tube and genetically modify people. And we're not quite at the stage where, you know, biohackers can do it in their garage yet. But in terms of editing humans, that, you know, but we are already at the stage where biohackers can do things like make glowing plants in their garage. Yeah. So we're really at a point where, you know, if literally anybody can do this, we're going to have to think really hard about how we regulate it.
Exactly. And it's going to be impossible to do potentially, because, you know, who knows who's going to get their hands on that. It'll be some lunatic billionaire who wants to create a new version of himself. Right. The three questions I want to ask you, what's one piece of advice that's been invaluable to your life, Andrew?
I think my favorite sort of bit of advice, a bit of an aphorism, it's the only cliche that I think my editors let me keep in the book, which was the best time to plant a tree is now. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, but the second best time is now. And I really felt that, I mean, I talk about it in the health advice chapter, and I think that's just so evocative in so many parts of life. I think I first read it on an investing blog, because you sort of think, oh, you know, if I want to save up for something, I'm saving for my pension or saving up for a house. Obviously, it would have been ideal if I'd been, you know, incredibly wise and started saving at 18. But actually, you know, if you're in your 30s, the second best time is to begin doing it now and start building that nest egg. And it's the same with the health advice, because, you know, you might think, oh, I'm 40, I've been drinking, I've been smoking, I haven't been doing enough exercise. But actually, I found some studies when I was researching the book of people who are in their 90s who started on these exercise programs, and it's substantially increasing like their walking speed, their strength. And so it's with almost anything, any skill you want to learn, any, you know, you want to do any savings, you want to do any health advice, anything, the best time to start, you know, it's frustrating you didn't start before, but you can still make a really big difference now.
Okay, I want to try and keep this within an hour, but I'm now going to leak slightly over, because I realize I'm going to have to ask you, for people listening to this, what is your advice to doing it yourself, to anti-aging advice yourself?
Well, as I say, there's a chapter about this in the book, and I think a lot of it is actually quite unsurprising health advice. So it's things like eating well, not eating too much, getting a bit of exercise is really powerful. Not smoking is just so important. That's my number one tip. If you're smoking and you want to live a long, healthy life, just, you know, try. I know it's hard, but try your best to quit, because it basically accelerates the aging process. And actually, that's what I found when I was researching that chapter. All of these things that sound like boring health advice, well, once you start to understand the aging biology, it really motivates you, because you understand that, you know, by eating well, by not eating too much, by exercising, by not smoking, etc., you are literally slowing down your aging. So that really excited me to get on with it. And the other thing you find is that there are some bits of health advice that you wouldn't expect just sort of naively. So, for example, I found that brushing your teeth can significantly slow down your aging as well. And the reason is that in your mouth, you've got, you know, various bacteria that are causing tooth decay, that are causing gum disease. They cause a process called inflammation, which is basically your immune system responding to the threat. But the problem is that as we get older, that inflammation can accelerate problems like heart disease. It can even potentially accelerate dementia. So it could be that brushing your teeth, you know, if you think about the aging biology, could slow down the onset of dementia, which has definitely encouraged me to do that as well.
Okay, final question. That's great advice. Final question. What is the meaning of life, Andrew?
I think it's probably be kind. I'm an atheist. I don't think that ethics, you know, exists other than as a human construct. And so what I want is a world where, you know, we're all just nice to each other. The reason that I'm doing what I'm doing is because I want to minimize the amount of human suffering. And I think that, you know, all of us should just try and go about our everyday lives in ways that try and minimize the suffering and maximize the happiness of everyone around us and everyone on the whole planet.
Thank you so much for doing that. I thoroughly enjoyed your book, by the way. I really enjoyed reading through it. I learned so much. And it just, as you can tell, it's firing off so much, so many thoughts in my mind. Sorry, some of them are a bit strange. But I just think I love listening to people like you talk about these subjects. You've done so much research. If people want to follow you, where's the best way? Is it Twitter?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter. I'm at Statto, at STATTO. And I'm on YouTube, youtube.com/Dr. Andrew Steele, so Dr. Andrew Steele. I'm going to be making some videos about some of the issues that this book throws up, actually. So there's going to be plenty more on there as well.
Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quooker. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com. Or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.